Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 47 of the Historic Performance Podcast featuring Andrew Flutt. I really appreciate the increased audience interaction that has been happening the past couple of weeks. As you probably noticed on Twitter, I've been posting hashtags. So you'll be seeing hashtag HPP, which stands for Historic Performance Podcast, and then a number which corresponds with the episode number. All upcoming episodes, because I know that many of you want to have the opportunity to ask questions to guests. And while I may not be able to get to all of them, I'm going to try including as many questions as possible within the podcast episode. I think ultimately this is going to provide a better experience to you. This week I'm chatting with Andrew Flutt, and he is a PhD candidate at the University of Alabama. And he does a lot of research on HRV, or heart rate variability. In today's podcast, he talks about the research behind HRV, why we use HRV in order to monitor recovery status in athletes, and just some practical considerations that coaches and athletes should be thinking about before purchasing an HRV application. There are many new ones on the market, and he just goes through a list of what you should be looking for when making that purchase. Hope you enjoy it. Let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm really happy to welcome Andrew Flutt. He's a doctoral candidate at the University of Alabama, and today we're going to be chatting about HRV, or heart rate variability. Andrew, how are you?
Hi James, how you doing? Good to be here. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Andrew, it's an absolute pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I know that it's taken a while in terms of scheduling, but we're finally here.
I appreciate your patience with all that. It's obviously been a bit hectic for me over the last couple of years, but I appreciate the opportunity to be here, especially because of how frequently I take advantage of the material you're putting out. So I'd say about two or three times a week, I'm consuming, you know, a podcast. And I remember particularly Brian Mann was one of your first guests, I think, earlier in November. So that's kind of when I first heard of the Historic Performance Podcast. And Dr. Mike Young had another good one that I was able to listen to. So yeah, just happy to kind of pay it back a little bit.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. Andrew, just start us off. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and just how you ended up now being a doctoral candidate at the University of Alabama?
Yeah, it's kind of been a long road to get into the PhD process, which was kind of a little bit of a pipe dream growing up, because I wasn't always a really good student. In fact, I was much more of your typical jock than I was anything of a student. I played hockey my whole life for about, I'd say, at least 12 years. At which point, when I was 16 years old, I kind of got sick of it. And that's when I gravitated to a few other sports. I had started playing rugby in high school, which I really enjoyed. I played lock. And then eventually started playing football at high school. And that's when I ended up playing college football at a small university in Ontario called Wilfrid Laurier University. We won a national championship in 2005. And outside of that, I got into a little bit of powerlifting, which is interesting because that's ultimately what led me to my interest in heart rate variability and this whole pursuit of, you know, the academic side. Which, if I didn't find this interest in heart rate variability, I probably would have had no interest in pursuing any kind of graduate studies. I bought an HRV app when I had just failed miserably at preparing for my second powerlifting competition. I overreached myself, and I was basically looking for some kind of objective physiological marker that I could monitor to have seen that coming, or how I could have responded to it a little bit better with adjusting training. And that's kind of what led me to monitoring heart rate variability. I purchased an app, I think it was in 2011. I think it was the only app available at the time, and that was iFleet. And man, like, let me tell you, I knew nothing about this stuff. In fact, when I bought the chest strap and the receiver from iFleet, I didn't even realize that you had to moisten the chest strap before you did an HRV recording. And so I was emailing the creator of iFleet. I was like, hey man, I ordered the iFleet and it's not working. He's like, well, explain to me what you're doing. And I'm like, oh, I'm putting on the heart rate strap. I'm inserting the receiver and I'm not getting any signal. He's like, I think you need to moisten the chest strap. And so that was a little bit embarrassing. But I hope I've kind of redeemed myself a little bit with in the past, I don't know, however many years since then, have been aggressively kind of pursuing and learning about this topic and just trying to understand these trends that I was seeing, but I couldn't explain. So throughout training and different experiences, whether it was travel or periods of high stress, illness, I would see these changes in my HRV and I knew they were meaningful, but I didn't have the strong physiological or training or education and the physiology that I wanted to really understand these findings. And right after my master's degree was around 2012 at California University of Pennsylvania. I was a graduate assistant strength and conditioning coach there. And I developed and devoted all of my academic work to researching heart rate variability, just in terms of the available literature. But it was a course-based master's. I wasn't doing any actual research in terms of in the lab or experimental studies. And it was right when I finished up my master's degree that I met who is now my PhD advisor and one of my really good friends, Dr. Mike Esko. And I met him at an NSCA conference in 2012 in Rhode Island. I was there. It was my first big conference, and I was walking through the posters, and I was hoping to see something on heart rate variability because I was so into it at the time and anxious, and I knew how powerful of a metric it could be. So I was like, this thing's got to be growing. There's probably going to be all this research. And there was one poster of the entire conference that would pertain to heart rate variability, and it was Mike Esko. And you know, this was in 2012. He looked much younger back then. And he's probably, he looks a little bit older now, probably from working with me for so long. But I approached him at his poster, and I thought he was a graduate student. I didn't realize that he was an established researcher and scientist and had all these publications. And I kind of didn't agree with his findings on his poster. So I started challenging him a little bit, and maybe a little too aggressively, not because I was a jerk, but just because I was so interested. And then when I looked, you know, we kind of ended the conversation. I looked him up and I realized, oh man, this guy's actually, he's got his PhD, he's done all this research. And I felt bad about our, you know, our exchange. So I sent him an email and I was like, hey man, I just want to apologize if I came on a little strong. I was just really excited to see a poster pertaining, you know, to heart rate variability, this and that. And he responded, he's like, hey man, it was great to see someone, you know, with that much interest, you know, and then we connected the next day and we stayed in touch via email after the conference. And at some point I just said to him, listen, I'd love to get some research experience in heart rate variability. I've been using it for all these years. I got this app, I've been using it with athletes. And there's so many gaps in the research, you know, that it doesn't appear to be built to being filled. Let's do it. Like, I don't think anyone else is doing any kind of smartphone HRV stuff. So let's be that group. And he invited me down to where he was, which was University of Auburn and at the Montgomery campus. And I packed up my bags and I moved to Alabama. And that's where we first started. Our first project was validating the smartphone app. So he's like, you're using the smartphone app, right? And he's like, is it accurate? And I was like, I don't know. I think so. And so he's like, well, let's test it. So that was my first research study that got published in 2013. And it was a very simple comparison of the iFleet application with an EKG. And I think we did 25 subjects. We brought them in, laid them down, hooked them up to the EKG, measured with them with the app at the same time, then compared the numbers. And it was accurate. And then it was like, all right, it's time to start applying this with athletes. And then we kind of got involved with the cross country team, the soccer team. And that's kind of where a bunch of our publications came from, is specifically is with the Auburn Montgomery women's soccer team. And then in addition to that, we did a few methodological studies. So, you know, in terms of validating 60-second or what we call ultra-short HRV recordings. You know, can we get away with a one-minute test versus a traditional five-minute test? So those were, there were some studies we did in addition to collaborating with a colleague in Brazil, Dr. Fabio Nakamura. So we've been pretty productive over the last couple of years. And that experience at Auburn Montgomery with the research really showed me that this is something I love to do, and encouraged me to pursue a PhD. So I applied to University of Alabama, ended up getting accepted, applied for a graduate assistant role. And I think Dr. Esko helped me out with that because he actually applied for a teaching position at Alabama around the same time he got hired. So we kind of both moved together from Montgomery, Alabama to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to the University of Alabama. So we've been continuing to work together ever since.
Andrew, when it comes to HRV, what exactly is being measured when you are assessing HRV?
Okay, so at the most basic level, to measure heart rate variability, what we're actually measuring is your heart rate with a very high precision so that we can look at the time difference between successive heartbeats. And that's traditionally and most accurately performed with an electrocardiograph in a laboratory where we can get a very high sampling frequency. I think traditionally used would be about 1,000 Hertz. And that's all you need really is just the measurement of time between heartbeats. And then you can derive heart rate variability metrics from the R-to-R intervals. And there's numerous HRV parameters that we could use. It just depends on what you're interested in looking at and for what purpose.
Previously, you mentioned the R-to-R intervals. What exactly is that reflecting? And what is the basis of using HRV as a recovery status tool?
Yeah, so that's a good question in terms of what is heart rate variability reflecting. So we measure these RR intervals, and through various, you know, mathematical or statistical procedures, we can get these heart rate variability metrics. Ultimately, what we're trying to get from these RR intervals is a reflection of cardiovascular autonomic control. And our heart rate has the ability or has an intrinsic mechanism that enables it to beat on its own. So we have what's called the SA node, which generates impulses. And if left alone, if you were to kind of remove any kind of nervous innervation of the heart, your resting heart rate would be about 100 beats per minute. But because we have autonomic innervation of the heart through parasympathetic nerve fibers and sympathetic nerve fibers, we could actually modulate heart rate by speeding it up above 100 beats per minute, kind of like pushing on the accelerator, or we can actually reduce heart rate substantially, to less than 60 beats per minute. And that all has to do with the autonomic nervous system. Specifically, extending from the cardiovascular control center of the brainstem, we have the vagus nerves, which directly innervate the SA node. And by releasing the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, the effect that it has on the SA node is it actually inhibits it. It slows down depolarization. So heart rate is reduced and slows down and is more variable. And the variation in heart rate is largely affected by respiration rate. So when you breathe in, for example, heart rate speeds up. And then when you breathe out, heart rate tends to slow down. And that's where we tend to see a lot of the variability. In contrast, during periods of stress or exercise, sympathetic fibers that innervate the myocardium release the neurotransmitter norepinephrine, which when binds to adrenergic receptors within the myocardium, it actually increases the rate of depolarization as well as contractility. So the heart rate is actually going to speed up. The heart's going to beat more forcefully. And because it's sped up, there's going to be less variability between heartbeats. And so let's take a bout of exercise, for example. So in the context of why would we use heart rate variability as a measure of recovery status, we're essentially looking at when parasympathetic activity kind of returns to baseline, and we consider, you know, what your resting heart rate is before baseline. Before exercise, we can kind of consider that your baseline. And then right before exercise, we have an anticipatory effect on the heart called central command, where just kind of knowing that you're about to exercise, we get an increase in heart rate. And then, you know, as exercise progresses, so let's say I'm running on a treadmill and I start to increase exercise intensity, I'm increasing the demand for oxygen peripherally at the muscle tissue. And when I start to exceed the lactate threshold, what that means is I'm starting to produce more lactate than I can clear. And this starts to affect or stimulate what's called the metaboreflex, where peripheral chemoreceptors are detecting changes in lactate concentration, hydrogen ion accumulation, inorganic phosphate, and so forth. And it sends that information afferently to the brain, the cardiovascular control center. And then its response is, okay, there's all this metabolite buildup. We need to deliver more oxygen and we need to clear more waste products. How do we do that? By increasing circulation. And to do that, we need to increase our respiration rate. We need to increase heart rate. Then there's also chemoreceptors that are sensitive to changes in oxygen content and carbon dioxide, which will affect heart rate. You have mechanoreceptors located in muscle tissue that are basically sensitive to changes in muscle length that, again, when muscle is being activated more frequently, it's essentially telling the brain that more oxygen is going to be needed because that's how we produce energy aerobically. So during this process, we're also creating a bunch of heat. When we metabolize energy nutrients, such as carbohydrates or fats, we don't end up getting the full amount of energy as ATP. We're actually very inefficient at producing energy. We lose a lot of it as heat. So we're increasing internal temperature as exercise persists. And this can be exacerbated based on the temperature or the weather conditions. So if we're exercising outside, for example, and there's not much of a temperature gradient between our body temperature and the atmospheric temperature, we end up, you know, for example, if it's really hot outside, we're not going to be able to dissipate heat nearly as easily as if it was cool outside. So we continue to add heat stress to our body. And why that's significant on heart rate is because our body is challenged with dissipating heat by directing more blood flow peripherally to the skin. So if you think about it, we have more blood flow at the surface of our skin because it's trying to lose heat. We have less blood centrally to be used for delivering oxygen and removing waste products. So we're basically now trying to accomplish more with less. So that's going to increase heart rate. And depending on duration of exercise and humidity, we can also be losing a lot of fluid via perspiration. So that's another mechanism through which we try and dissipate heat, is by sweating, and specifically the evaporation of the sweat allows us to lose a little bit of that heat. But ultimately, this is all going to contribute to fluid loss. So that's kind of, you know, heart rate is affected directly through all these events that are happening during exercise. And it's the recovery process of restoring homeostasis that is also can be reflected in heart rate. And that's because the return of heart rate back to baseline after exercise is related to the clearance of plasma catecholamine content. So, you know, the norepinephrine that's released from the sympathetic nerve endings, as well as from the medulla, adrenal medulla, clearance of lactate and metabolites, all of these things are going to, heart rate's going to remain elevated until we remove these from circulation. Thermoregulation, we talked about how heart rate is involved in trying to cool the body. So as body temperature remains elevated after exercise, heart rate kind of remains elevated as well until we restore body temperature back to normal ranges. And I should say body temperature doesn't change dramatically. We actually have a very fine range of how high and low body temperature can get. But, a little bit makes a big difference. Then the fluid balance is also something that we need to consider, especially for not just the acute response to an exercise session, but, you know, 24 and 48 hours later. What happens is when we lose all this fluid from training, particularly from perspiration, as well as during exercise, we get some plasma volume shifting. When there's less plasma in the blood, we actually end up getting a decrease in blood pressure, and the autonomic nervous system responds by increasing heart rate to try and restore blood pressure to maintain peripheral resistance. So the changes in plasma volume can directly affect resting heart rate and heart rate variability. Specifically, in some interesting research by Martin Boucher, I think it was in 2009 in a study in the European Journal of Applied Physiology, they found an almost perfect relationship between the changes in HRV after a grueling high intensity training session. I think they did repeated yo-yo tests or something out in the heat. It was a pretty intense protocol. Anyway, when they were measuring HRV during the follow-up to that, up to 72 hours, and when plasma volume was restored back to or above baseline, that's kind of when HRV really returned to baseline levels. And I think the mechanism behind that is when we get that increase in plasma volume, that activates the baroreceptor reflex, which all of a sudden we have a lot of volume in the blood. And that is going to transiently increase blood pressure. And because we don't want blood pressure to be too high out of our normal, we respond by reducing heart rate by increasing parasympathetic activity to heart. So you have all these factors that we just talked about, the clearance of metabolite buildup, return of body temperature to homeostasis, restoration of fluid balance, and plasma volume changes. All these are important factors that go into kind of the recovery of your body physiologically from a training session. I think it's important to mention that there are other facets of recovery that may not be reflected in heart rate variability. And that includes, for example, muscle damage. It's unclear right now if, for example, inflammatory responses, changes in testosterone concentration. There's not enough research right now for us to conclusively say whether or not HRV is a reasonable reflection of these other facets of recovery. But when you consider the ones that we kind of just discussed, it kind of gives you some physiological basis for why we would want to know when HRV is back at baseline after intense training. And I would encourage, if the kind of the mechanisms behind this, I would really encourage anyone listening to look at Jamie Stanley and Martin Boucher's paper on parasympathetic reactivation after exercise and its implications for exercise prescription. I learned a lot from that article, and that'll give you a much better explanation of the process than probably what I just provided. But hopefully that gives you a general idea.
No, definitely. And one thing to mention is HRV, especially in kind of the athletic setting, has really been evolving over the past couple of years. So when it comes to athlete monitoring, what are the HRV parameters that are commonly used?
Yeah, so we talked about how there was various parameters for HRV. The one that we've been focusing on as a result of some previous research, specifically by Martin Boucher, Daniel Plews, Jamie Stanley, and kind of those guys, is RMSSD, which stands for the root mean square of successive art of our interval differences. And there's a few reasons why this has been suggested as the preferred parameter for monitoring athletes, specifically in field conditions, which is pretty much how we're all going to be using it for athlete monitoring purposes. So I'm kind of going to give you a little rundown about why that is. So for one, RMSSD is accepted as a marker of parasympathetic activity. And we kind of just talked about how monitoring parasympathetic activity changes can be useful for, you know, determining recovery status. It's sensitive to stress, fatigue, and training-induced changes. So that could be changes in fitness. It could be acute fatigue. It could be any kind of stress, whether it's training, it could be training-related, could be school-related, could be work-related. It can be reflected in RMSSD. So it's sensitive to a bunch of these factors that we're trying to manage with our athletes. Another important aspect is that it's less influenced by breathing rate. Certain HRV parameters can change quite dramatically based on how you're breathing. So if you're breathing more frequently or less frequently, deep breaths or so forth can drastically change some HRV parameters. But it appears that RMSSD is less influenced by respiration rate. That doesn't mean that if you drastically change your breathing from day to day, that RMSSD will be affected by that, but not nearly as much probably as some of these other markers of HRV, such as high frequency spectral power and low frequency spectral power, for instance. And that's important. That's an important consideration for athletes, because if we are not supervising an HRV recording, then breathing cadence, we don't know if they're following it every time. And we don't want to have any kind of our HRV metrics obscured just because they're not consistent with how they're breathing. So a lot of apps provide a paced breathing cadence because it's believed that this may add a component of reliability. It's been my experience that the athletes prefer not to pace their breathing. And I think that just has to do with what the selected pace is. So for example, seven to eight breaths per minute is a commonly used breathing frequency, because that was the mean breathing frequency of some high level endurance athletes. I think it was a study by Sabul in 2013 in Journal of Sports Sciences, or European Journal of Sports Science, one of those journals. And so we started applying that with athletes, or because it's already used on the app, but they're not the same population. And it's also important to consider that breathing frequency, I think, was measured in a supine position. But we tend to favor a seated position, which we can get into in a little bit. RMSSD is also one of your more reliable HRV parameters. And what that means is it's not going to fluctuate nearly as much on a day-to-day basis. There was a study by Hania Al-Haddad, and I think Martin Boucher was on that study as well, in, I think it was European Journal of Applied Phys. And they were basically looking at HRV on different days in the same subjects, and they were reporting the coefficient of variations. And RMSSD had one of the lower coefficient of variations, which is a marker of reliability. So there's basically less noise in that measure compared to some other HRV metrics. Another important consideration is that it's easy to interpret, especially with kind of scaling it on a 100 point scale. The RMSSD, when it's log transformed and multiplied by 20, it's basically fit on a 100 point scale. So you can see the closer you are to 100, the higher your parasympathetic activity. And it just makes it a lot easier for coaches to understand. Now, the scale for RMSSD in terms of out of 100, that I know iFleet uses that. I think they've patented that. Marco Altini's app HRV4 Training scales it in a different way. I think he factors in age as well as log transforming and putting it on a scale out of 10. So not all apps are going to be the same, but generally it's pretty easy to interpret compared to some other HRV metrics. And an area that that my PhD advisor and myself have really been developing is how suitable RMSSD is under ultra short recording periods. And some of our earlier studies were looking at, all right, so a traditional heart rate variability recording is 5 minutes in duration, and it's traditionally preceded by 5 minutes for stabilization. So what that means is you get someone in to the lab or however, wherever you're measuring them in the clinic, they're going to lay down for 5 minutes, and then you're going to record 5 minutes after the initial stabilization period of 5 minutes. So in total, it's a 10-minute procedure, which is, you know, if we're trying to get athletes to do this on a somewhat regular basis, 10 minutes, there's no way. So we were looking at, okay, how long does it really take RMSSD to stabilize after you're supine or seated? And if we were to isolate a 1 minute period out of the 5 minute criterion period, is it any different? And what we found was, you know, in the athletes that we looked at, which were collegiate cross country athletes, and then in collaboration with Dr. Fabio Nakamura in Brazil, he had a reasonably large sample of professional futsal players, which is indoor soccer. And we found that HRV or RMSSD specifically stabilizes in less than a minute, whether you're supine or seated. And taking 1 minute out of the 5 minute measure, there's no difference between the RMSSD values, at least not that would be very meaningful. That would, you know, give you a false positive or false negative from what we can tell. So we're pretty confident that RMSSD could be measured in essentially less than 2 minutes. You know, now I'm not saying we would necessarily want to use that for clinical diagnosis or anything, but for getting a quick snapshot of an athlete's resting parasympathetic activity, you know, a 1 minute recording period appears to be sufficient. So for all those reasons, RMSSD appears to be the preferred HRV metric.
One thing that you mentioned there is obviously the time factor. And this is something that I know talking with other coaches is something on their mind, especially when it comes to incorporating HRV into athlete monitoring. But something else that comes to mind is, what are kind of the best considerations when you're trying to measure HRV in the field? Does it have to be done in the morning? Do you have to be sensitive to fluid intake? These are just some of the questions I know that a lot of coaches bounce off one another, and I was hoping to hear your take on it.
Right. So, you know, what are the conditions that we should be measuring heart rate variability in? There are definitely a few considerations. Traditionally, I guess even before the waking heart rate variability measure, there was, you know, it was nocturnal HRV measures that were preferred. But the problem with acquiring heart rate variability during sleep is that you end up with a ton of data. You have to kind of pray that the heart rate strap or whatever you're using maintains sufficient contact with the surface of the skin so that we can actually measure the heart rate. So it just wasn't convenient. It's certainly not for using every day with athletes to try to get a quick indication of recovery status and so forth. So, you know, that's eventually it was just, you know, okay, right when you wake up, before you've encountered any type of stressor for the day, you know, without having read your emails or ingested any fluid or food, you're in the most rested condition that you're probably going to be for the entire day. So let's capture it then. So that's kind of, you know, evolved to the point where, yeah, we want to measure it right after waking. That's ideal. Now, having been applying this in the field with athletes, there's obviously a compliance issue. And I know everyone's concerned about that. And so the question becomes, can we measure it at another time of day? And I would say for the most accurate, reliable conditions, you're going to want to do it after waking. But can we do it at another time of the day if we standardize things? I was very skeptical, and I still remain skeptical about this, but I have been collecting data recently. I got about 3 weeks worth of data on some very high level athletes, where we've been measuring at 1 PM, controlling for all other conditions that I'll talk about. And the data has been showing what we would expect to see and responding to training how we would expect. So as long as you're considering, you know, there are circadian variations in heart rate variability, you have a cortisol awakening response. As your body temperature increases throughout the day, your heart rate variability is probably going to go down a little bit. So measuring, if you're measuring on a daily basis, you want to be consistent with the time of day. So ideally it's after waking. If you're not doing it after waking, you're doing it at another time of the day. You want to standardize the procedures as much as possible. And there is some research to show that measuring not immediately after waking is sensitive to training effects. So for example, in one of our recent papers, which was a collaboration with Dr. Fabio Nakamura, he had data on changes in HRV before and after a preseason training camp. And he recorded that with traditional approaches. So they used, I think, a full 5 minute heart rate variability recording after a stabilization period. They did it before and after, and they saw increases in RMSSD. So we basically just reevaluated the data and just said, all right, we're going to look at we're actually going to cut out the first minute, consider that our 1 minute stabilization, and then we're going to look at minute two and see if the change in HRV from pre to post training was still evident when looking at the ultra short measure. And these were from HRV measures that were obtained at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the training facility where I think they were futsal players, were sitting on basically the bench in a gymnasium. And sure enough, the changes were observed in the ultra short measures. So that were measured at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it appears that if you can control for the position, the time of day, they controlled for fluid and food intake. I think they said that there was no eating or drinking of anything up to 2 hours before the measure. And it was sensitive. Now, that's one study. We obviously need more research to validate this type of procedure, but it's showing promise. And I wouldn't say you're completely out of luck if you can't get a measure first thing when you wake up. I mean, worst case scenario, you just start doing it and see if how the data is responding. If it's really noisy, then, you know, maybe it's not. The data that I've been collecting recently has been showing that we can get some meaningful data measured later in the afternoon if we can control for certain factors. Breathing is obviously, we kind of already touched on it and how that could affect HRV, but we want to be consistent with, if we're going to be breathing spontaneously, just our kind of whatever our normal breathing pace is at that given time, we have to be consistent with it. We can't pace our breathing one day and then not do it the other day, because it may have some, even though the effects are small on RMSSD, we want to take care of all the factors that we can control, and that would be one of them. Measurement position is another important consideration for kind of how HRV, how do we measure it, and what's meaningful for training. Traditionally, supine heart rate variability recordings were basically the standard approach. But I, from personal use for the last several years, I've been measuring a supine heart rate variability recording every morning after I wake up, and then in addition to a standing HRV recording. And I can tell you that they're not the same thing. You know, it may be thought that, you know, supine and standing is probably, the trends are probably going to be the same. Just supine, your number is going to be, your HRV is going to be higher because your heart is not challenged to pump blood vertically up to the brain. You're laying, like, you're at a real relaxed resting condition. Whereas when you're standing, you're going to have a quick change in blood pressure, which is going to have a quick result and a quick spike in heart rate to, deliver blood and oxygen to the brain so that you don't pass out. But what I'm finding is that when you measure HRV, either in a supine or in a standing position, the numbers are a little bit different. And this has been a real interest of mine kind of since day one. And one of the reasons why I like a standing or more recently, we've been using a seated position, and I'll get into that for reasons why. But there was an interesting paper by, I hope I don't pronounce his name wrong, but Heike Rusko. And he is a Scandinavian researcher who worked with very high level cross-country skiers, I believe. And he was doing a morning heart rate test to evaluate recovery status, kind of similar to how we're using heart rate variability. He would simply look at what the average of their heart rate, resting heart rate, was when they were laying down. And then upon standing up, he would look at where heart rate peaks at about 15 seconds after standing. And then about a minute or two later, where heart rate stabilizes. So you're laying down, heart rate is nice and low, you're rested, you stand up, heart rate spikes in response to the vertical challenge of pumping blood up to the brain. And then it's going to stable and level off somewhere after about a minute or two of standing. And what he was finding was that you were more likely to be fatigued, stressed, or experiencing some type of illness if your heart rate spiked really high after you stood up. And when it finally stabilized, it remained significantly elevated above kind of what your normal would be. And then in contrast, in the test, if after you stood up, heart rate kind of hits its peak, but then it stabilizes much quicker and at a much lower heart rate level, that indicated that you were well recovered, you were improving your fitness, adaptation was going well. So you're basically doing a quick stress test on yourself to see how you can overcome and adapt to a little challenge, such as standing up. And basically, if you can accommodate to that challenge, respond and adapt to it very well, and then heart rate normalizes and you're good to go, that would be indicative of a good restful state. Whereas if you stand up and your body is you know, appears to be challenged by that, and it's not stabilizing or falling down to its normal level, it's still trying to adapt to the stimulus. Usually that means that it's also challenged with various other sorts of stressors. Any kind of residual fatigue or training stress or what have you, that it's just not, probably not in an ideal condition for intense training that day. So that was some large motivation for me to measure my heart rate variability standing, because it was just like, all right, so if I stand up and measure my heart rate variability at the same time, after about 1 minute after standing, you know, I'm basically capturing the essence of this Rusco test that I was just talking about. There are some factors to consider though for positional changes. So how soon after you stand up, for example, can affect your heart rate variability. If you measure your heart rate variability too soon after standing, you're going to be capturing that sympathetic response and heart rate variability will be much lower, and heart rate will be higher. Where, you know, so you do have to give it, you know, at least a minute for you to stabilize. More recently in some papers, in Martin Boucher's big paper in Frontiers of Physiology, and Jamie Stanley's paper in Sports Medicine, they were recommending the seated position. And I think the motivation for that was mostly because in the populations that they were working with, such as, you know, high level endurance athletes, they can encounter a phenomenon called parasympathetic saturation when you're in the supine position. And essentially, in a nutshell, what that is you have an abundance of acetylcholine within the myocardium that is constantly attaching to the cholinergic receptors and exerting its effects on heart rate, which is to impede or slow down impulses from the SA node. So, well, in these highly fit athletes in the supine position, there was just so much, there was saturation of the cholinergic receptors that we weren't getting those changes in heart rate in response to respiration. So despite having a really low resting heart rate, there just wasn't much variability between heartbeats because it was just that chronic activation of the cholinergic receptor. So we can overcome that issue. There's you know, statistical approaches that they can look at to determine if you're experiencing saturation. But I think more simply, if we just sit someone and up or have them stand up, we're gonna overcome the issue of parasympathetic saturation. So another important consideration is how much day-to-day variability you're gonna experience and a standing measure versus a supine measure. So there's no doubt that measuring in the supine position will limit how much day-to-day variability there is. And I think that's just because it's a much more stable condition. You're laying down, there's no impact on, you know, if you do it standing, how long you waited. Seated, I think, is kind of the compromise between a standing measure and a supine measure. It's more stable than standing. You're supported by the chair. Your heart rate's not going to be, it's not going to spike up quite as high. It's overcoming the effects of saturation. And we're still taking advantage of that small orthostatic stimulus, you know, that, you know, we learned about in the Rusco test of how that might be meaningful for assessing training status. So all that being said, currently, my recommendation would be to measure in a seated position.
One of the other questions that I think would be beneficial for a lot of listeners is, you know, there's a lot of HRV apps out there. So what considerations should coaches or individuals make when they're purchasing an HRV application?
It almost seems like there's a new smartphone HRV app on the market every day. If you were to search in the iTunes store or on the Google Play store, you'll come across numerous apps that are all capable of measuring HRV. So I think your first question that you have to ask yourself, and there's a bunch, because I don't think that there's one single app that's going to accommodate everyone's needs and everyone's different situations. So I'll kind of cover some important considerations that I think you need to ask yourself before you start using an app, whether it's for yourself or for a team. So first, is it accurate? Not all the apps obviously have been tested by a third party and compared with an EKG to determine if they are fully accurate. We validated iFleet, like I said, back in 2013. I think that was the first time, maybe, that I was aware of that a smartphone app had been tested, and we found that it was acceptably accurate. Recently, we actually have a paper it's already been in review for a while. We've done one round of the revision, so we're hoping to hear back soon on if it gets accepted or not. But we looked at the accuracy of the finger sensor that functions with iFleet. And we looked at how it agreed with EKG in the supine seated and standing position. So, without getting too much into the results, I would say that we're confident that it's an acceptable measure or an acceptable tool for acquiring HRV. Again, not something we would necessarily want to use in a clinical setting with patients involved in like any kind of cardiac rehab, or we want very little room for error. But as a quick, convenient way to acquire heart rate variability on a daily basis, it appears to be suitable for that, especially because when you consider the effect on compliance that, the additional steps that it takes to put on a heart rate strap, and heaven forbid you have to walk to the sink to moisten the back of the strap, any kind of little step you add that your athlete has to do, it's going to affect compliance. So one less step is with a finger sensor, for example, is not having to put on a strap. Now there's apps, Marco Altini's app, HRV4 Training, allows you to measure heart rate variability just by placing your fingertip over the lens of the camera, and the flash turns on and it is basically picking up pulse from your fingertip. And I know that's being, we did a little bit of cross validation stuff on that, but not something that I was able to get enough subjects in yet. It's kind of been ongoing, but, I know recently, Daniel Plews and Paul Lorson out of New Zealand, are looking at how accurate that is. So, and I think their results are promising. So even though a lot of these apps haven't been tested in a lab and it hasn't been published, I would say that the technology is pretty available. And for the most part, these are probably, if used correctly, they are probably going to give you a reasonably accurate measure of heart rate variability. So for the most part, I think accuracy isn't a huge issue, but it's obviously, I mean, if you're using a tool that's inaccurate, that's obviously going to be a big problem. But I would say with reasonable confidence that most of them are going to be accurate. And worst case scenario, give it to someone in your department or in the ex-phys department and have them do a quick, even just one or two subjects that you can compare really easily. Just look at the values that the app gives you, look at the values that the EKG gives you, and you can compare them if you have any kind of concern about an app that hasn't been published on, for example. You have to ask yourself, is this an app that I want to use for myself, for my own training? So if you're an athlete listening, or if you're a coach that wants to use it with athletes, you need to consider that some apps have a team interface where when an athlete performs a heart rate variability measure, it automatically gets uploaded to a team interface so that you could see pretty much in real time who did their HRV measure at what time and what the values are. So there's a few apps that offer that, but certainly not all of them. You also need to consider, if you are measuring HRV on a team, having done that with several teams now, the compliance is a real issue. So it's much easier to have them come into the facility and measure heart rate variability in standardized conditions at the facility. There's apps that offer the ability to populate a single app on an iPad, for example, and then have that app on various iPads, where you can basically just pass around a couple iPads and have the athletes doing their HRV measure in the facility rather than having them all download the app on their own phone. So those are kind of some logistical considerations you want to have. Cost. What is your budget? Some apps, they range. Some are free. I think Elite HRV is an app that's for free, that you can download for free. Marco Altini's app is, I think, $4.99. iFleet, the app, is, I think, $8.99. Omega Wave, I think, costs a little bit more, but you're getting a little bit more sophisticated metrics and algorithms based on their database. So cost is going to be an important consideration. Compatibility. What device do you have, or do your athletes have? So for example, not all apps will work on Samsung devices. So they might only function on iOS. The camera phone HRV, any app that's using a camera phone to measure HRV through your finger is great. But if it doesn't work on an iPad, because there's no camera flash on the iPad yet, as of now, as of the current iPad. So if you're trying to measure HRV on your team via iPad, that's not going to be an option. They would all have to download the app on an iOS smartphone. Duration of measure. how long for the app that you're using, how long is the HRV recording period? And if it's using RM SSD, so we're pretty confident that we can get a good measure of RM SSD in 1 minute. So I'm probably not going to want to use an app that uses a recording period much longer than a minute, not because that's bad. I mean, the longer the measure, probably the better, but when factoring in the daily compliance of, can we get the athlete to sit still for much more than a minute without talking or texting or who knows what, right? So duration of the measure is important. So I'm looking for about a 1 minute test. The HRV parameter used. So some apps provide multiple HRV parameters. If it's only doing a 1 minute test though, it's I'm not sure how good the frequency domain measures are acquired from only a 1 minute recording. So I think you're supposed to have at least 2 minutes worth of RDR interval data to get a good measure of low frequency spectral power. So that's a consideration. What other training status metrics does your app, your HRV app, include? So is your app only measuring heart rate variability and then giving you your score of what your heart rate variability is? Does it also have a wellness questionnaire? Or does it allow you to monitor training load by inputting a rating of perceived exertion or any kind of training load value? Does it integrate with any kind of other products like a Fitbit or does it sync to Training Peaks, which some of the apps are starting to do? So your questioning now is how much more can I get out of it than just HRV? Kind of one of the last things I want to talk about for considerations. And what I think, you know, when we've taken care of accuracy, we've taken care of compatibility, compliance issues, what's most important to me is what app provides the best visualization of the data over time. And the reason for that is traditionally, and especially for research purposes, we're going to download the raw data into a spreadsheet and we're going to apply some statistics. We're going to look at, for example, the swells worthwhile change. We might look at effect sizes when comparing weekly averages. We are looking at what's called the coefficient of variation, which is based on the standard deviation of a period. So for example, over a 1 week period where you have 7 HRV measures, we could look at the average, which is your weekly average or your weekly mean. And then we calculate the coefficient of variation, which is the standard deviation divided by the mean times 100. And that gives us a good indication of how much the score, your HRV, fluctuated across the week. However, if you have an app that provides a very good visualization of the data, then it really limits, and in some cases may eliminate, the need for downloading and doing any kind of analysis in the spreadsheet. If the app restricts the view of your data to like just 1 week, or if it's only giving you your daily change, I think it's not nearly as useful as if the data can be visualized over a period of time, because how your HRV changes over time, whether there's greater fluctuation during a certain period, whether it's increasing or it's decreasing, you want to see how you have evolved or your HRV has evolved over training during these different phases to see how you've adapted and to what kind of loads and so forth. So from an analytical perspective, visualization of the data is one of the most important things I'm looking at when deciding an app. So I think in a nutshell, those are some important considerations before you purchase and start using an app with yourself or with a team.
Andrew, one of the recent studies that you're involved in, which was published in the Journal of Sports Medicine and Physical Fitness, is something I think would be pretty interesting to a lot of the listeners here since they're involved in soccer. And it was titled Interpreting Daily Heart Rate Variability Changes in Collegiate Female Soccer Players. So could you tell us a little bit about this study and what conclusions you drew from it?
Yeah, so this was a study that actually was from data that we collected in the soccer team back in 2014. So it just shows you how long the process is to write up the paper, get it in through peer review, and eventually get it published. And I actually, because I wanted to look at the data a little bit differently, I actually invited Daniel Plews to help collaborate, as well as Dr. Fabio Nakamura, just to help me with some of the progressive stats, the Hopkins-based stats that, you know, we're not going to really learn in the classroom here, at least, most programs here throughout the U.S. in graduate school, you're learning statistics, but primarily inferential statistics and null hypothesis, significance testing and p-values and ANOVAs and t-tests and all that kind of stuff, which are certainly important and useful, you know, when applied correctly. But in terms of performance and changes in some of these metrics, the magnitude-based inferences, kind of, you know, Hopkins-based statistics that Martin Boucher really talks about in one of his recent papers in Frontiers in Physiology. I honestly just wasn't schooled in how to apply those necessarily. Dr. Daniel Plouze was really helpful in that regard. So essentially what we did was and 10 female soccer players, or women's collegiate soccer players, we evaluated daily heart rate variability. They measured when they woke up with the iFleet application. They did a brief wellness questionnaire where they rated their perceived levels of fatigue, sleep quality, mood, stress, and so forth. At the time, it was a 5-point scale. And we measured training load with a session rating of perceived exertion. So after any kind of training session, whether it was resistance training, a conditioning session, or the practice session, we would get them to rate their perceived exertion on the CR10 Borg scale. And if it was from the weight room, we would multiply it by the number of repetitions that were completed during the workout. And if it was field-based, like a soccer practice or conditioning session, we would multiply it by the number of minutes and duration of the session. So that's how we quantified training load. During the 2-week period, week one was considered a high load week, where intensity and volume and so forth was higher. And then in week two, we performed the exact same structure. So the same exercises, it was the same workouts at the same time, practices at the same time, everything, the nature of the workout, it was basically mirrored. The difference was volume and basically just volume was reduced. So we wanted to see, you know, what we should see is some kind of changes in HRV. And I think one of the questions we were trying to get at is, can we use an ultra short HRV recording, a 1-minute period, on a daily basis from a smartphone? Is it sensitive to changes in training load? And so in a nutshell, what we found was during the high training load week, we saw greater reductions in the group. So for example, after Mondays and Thursdays, which were had a strength and conditioning workout in the morning, followed by a soccer practice in the afternoon, and then we would finish off with conditioning. Those were the most intense days, Mondays and Thursdays. And we were seeing at a group level decreases in HRV after those days. And then during the low load week, when we basically did the exact same training routine, we just reduced intensity and maybe volume a little bit, we saw much smaller reductions in HRV in response to that. So at a group level, we saw what we were hoping and what we would expect to see, which is, you know, after intense training, there is going to be some fatigue and we're going to see decreases in HRV. And then during the low load week, they've already been exposed to this stimulus and it's not as great as a stimulus, so they should be less perturbed from it, at least with regards to their heart rate variability responses, also their perceived soreness and so forth. What was unique about this paper was that I really wanted to get at how does this look on an individual basis, because we know that the group average is almost meaningless when you're really trying to zone in on one person. Because if you were to look at the paper, the confidence intervals on the daily changes in heart rate variability are very wide, meaning what that tells us is that some athletes on the day after Monday or Thursday, so after a really hard training day, some athletes showed really big decreases in HRV. Some athletes showed small decreases in HRV. Some athletes were pretty well recovered, at least with regards to their HRV, by one day after the training session. So what we're seeing is these different responses in these athletes. So inspired by one of Martin Boucher's earlier papers, I think it was a 2010 paper in European Journal of Applied Physiology, he was looking at what explained day-to-day variations in youth soccer players. And he found a significant correlation between they were youth male soccer players, I believe. There was a significant correlation between their maximum aerobic speed and how much their HRV fluctuated on a daily basis. And the more fit subjects showed less day-to-day variation. They had a more stable trend. We had tested our subjects on the yo-yo intermittent recovery test level one, and we also had VO2 max values. So I was like, all right, well, let's see if when we measure HRV at rest in the morning after waking, do we, with an ultra short HRV measure, are we going to find something similar as what Boucher and his colleagues found? And the reason why that's an important question is because they looked at post-exercise heart rate variability after a submaximal run test. So they were looking at kind of how parasympathetic activity reactivated after a low intensity exercise session, which is not necessarily the same as a resting HRV measure, obviously. So that's kind of where this differed. So looking at the correlation, we found, again, a significant correlation between both VO2 max and yo-yo test with how much fluctuation the athletes experience. And we quantified fluctuation with the coefficient of variation that I mentioned earlier. So again, the athletes who showed the larger decreases in HRV after the high intensity training days, pretty much those were the ones that were our lower fit athletes. So I think of the entire group, the average yo-yo test score was 1400 meters. And the two lowest, the athletes with the lowest scores, which I think they had about 1100 meters on the yo-yo test, they specifically were the ones with the highest coefficient of variations across the 2 week period. But the correlation was negative 0.65, which tells us that yes, fitness itself plays an important role in how your HRV responds to training, but it doesn't explain everything. Looking at our perceptual measures, including perceived fatigue and so forth, we actually ended up seeing a significant correlation between perceived fatigue and your daily fluctuation HRV measured by the coefficient of variation. So kind of one thing we talk about in the discussion is one of our most fit athletes who had a yo-yo score, I think of it was over 1700 meters, I believe. She was actually experiencing quite large reductions in HRV in response to the training, which you wouldn't expect based on her fitness level, based on her experience being one of the more veteran athletes and so forth. But when we looked at her perceived levels of fatigue and soreness and so forth, they were lowest of the entire group. So what that's telling us, at least based on this small study, it was only 10 subjects, but it seems to confirm what some other studies have been showing, is if the athletes are showing considerable day-to-day variation in HRV, measured by the coefficient of variation, it's probably because they're of lower fitness level, or they're experiencing some non-training related stressors. So that can kind of help with interpretation of the HRV trend. If you have one of your stud athletes who's typically very fit, very accustomed to the training, and they're starting to show some large fluctuation, there's a good chance that it's not necessarily the training load that is the main issue, but some other kind of non-training related stressor. It could be illness. It could be academic stress. It could be any number of issues. You could have your pick. But it gives you some kind of insight into saying, okay, what are these non-training related stressors? How can we intervene to reduce them? And should we accommodate things a little bit by reducing loads because they're showing such high physiological stress here? Are they at any kind of risk? And so that's kind of giving us some insight with regards to that. Obviously, there's going to be more research needed with more subjects and more over a longer period of time. And that's something that we've been doing. So again, this study was from 2014. More recently, we've been looking at swimmers, collegiate level swimmers. We have data from during a baseline period, an overload and a taper leading into competition, and how the effects of their taper on heart rate variability affected their performance. So we're definitely seeing, I don't want to say we can predict if they're going to do well or not, because there's a lot of factors that go into that. But essentially a trend that we saw related to superior performance compared to athletes who underperformed and they weren't seeing this kind of clear trend that we were seeing. And it's nothing that you wouldn't expect. At baseline, your heart rate variability scores are kind of they're your normal daily response with daily fluctuation, but then all of a sudden you increase training loads for an overload period. And these were sprint swimmers. So specifically, it was an anaerobic overload period. We saw what we would have expected. We saw a decrease in their HRV, and we saw much more fluctuation on a daily basis. And then during the taper, when training loads were reduced, we saw HRV start to return to baseline or peak with much less day-to-day fluctuation. And that was a favorable response leading into competition based on how they ended up performing. Now taken with the soccer study that we were just talking about with the data and the swimmers and more recently working with football players, what I would kind of say is happening is we could kind of possibly distinguish kind of moderate fatigue from more severe fatigue based on the HRV responses. And I think what's first going to happen when training loads are increased or there's some type of increase in stress, you're going to see an increase in day-to-day fluctuation by your coefficient of variation. And that's simply, you're going to be stressed or perturbed physiologically in some way, your HRV is going to go down, but you will return to baseline or above. And it's just, there's going to be a bit of scattering of the numbers. And I would consider that to be just, you know, you're stimulated. That's a moderate level of fatigue. And we're aware of it. You know, there's this athlete went from this was their baseline and now they're much more scattered. It makes sense because we've increased training load or we're in a different phase. It's an expected response. And what you'll see is if it persists, the fluctuation's actually gonna go down. You're gonna see less day-to-day fluctuation in the scores. The scores are just gonna remain low. So HRV drops and it's not returning to baseline, which it's those changes in dropping and increasing back to baseline, which increases the coefficient of variation. But if you start to get more severely fatigued, your scores just aren't returning to baseline. They're remaining chronically suppressed. So if you're using HRV as an objective physiological marker to try and use as some indicator of training response, an increase in the CV with a slight decrease in your baseline is expected when you're stimulated and maybe some moderate fatigue. But when that changes to just chronic suppression, I think you're in a state of more fatigue. And it depends how far you are from competition and how much fatigue you want to accumulate, because there are times where we're trying to accumulate fatigue and really stimulate the athlete and so forth. But at least we can now be mindful of what these trends might be representing. At least in terms of a simple interpretation, just from visualizing the data. You could calculate the mean and the CV and look at the changes, but visualized graphically over time, if you're looking at the data, I mean, you could see when there's more fluctuation, you could see when there's less fluctuation. And it really does appear to be related to how you're responding to training. So one of our previous studies in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research showed that athletes who decreased their coefficient of variation after 3 weeks of training were the ones that eventually ended up having the higher scores on the yo-yo test, which tells us that they were probably adapting to and handling the training better than people who saw an increase in the coefficient of variation. The stimulus was too much for them, or they it wasn't the correct stimulus, or there's, it leads to a bunch of questions, but it shows that HRV measured somewhat on a regular basis, by looking at these trends, we can kind of determine if they're responding favorably or not, and therefore should we be making some type of training intervention. And I just want to add a caveat that this is primarily in team sport athletes and sprinters and football players, and really high level endurance athletes that are experiencing or undergoing very high volumes of endurance training. Increases in HRV have been associated with non-functional overreaching. So, but I just haven't seen that in any of the athletes I work with, and I don't work with triathletes or anything like that. So that is something people need to be mindful of, that increases in HRV during very intense training periods, specifically with endurance athletes, that might not be indicating that they're increasing fitness, or it's probably indicating that they're overreached. So you just have to put into context what type of athlete you're working with and what is the nature of the training load and so forth. So I hope that wasn't too confusing. It's much easier to explain if there's a picture of the data and you could kind of point to it here and there of what you're talking about. But hopefully in a nutshell, that gives you a little bit of insight into some of our recent findings.
No, definitely. And I think something that you touched upon is kind of how do you go about interpreting HRV measurements and changes in this previous point, which was kind of the way I wanted to end the podcast, because I know that's something that a lot of coaches try to find more information about. Like, how do I figure out where my athlete is at, what these HRV measurements mean, and then how soon should I make a training intervention based on the changes that I'm seeing?
Okay. Yeah. And I'm going to preface this by saying that there's not necessarily a right or best way to do it. I think that there's different metrics you could look at. For example, if you're looking at the acute change in an HRV, so you wake up, you do your HRV or you get your HRV measured and it's significantly lower from the day before, should we use that as a means to change training load? Personally, I tend to favor not being hypersensitive to a single acute or daily change in HRV, predominantly in team settings where they're going to be working out with the team and we've got this training structure. What I'm more concerned about is the trend. If I'm seeing more than 2 days in a row that HRV is continuing to go down, I might bring that to the attention of the coach, saying they're kind of trending down a little bit there and they haven't come back up yet. So just be mindful of this particular athlete. But I don't think we need to be hypersensitive. In fact, there's been two studies. The original study by Dr. Kivanyemi, I think it was 2007 in MedSci, Medicine, Science, Sport, and Exercise. They looked at, compared pre-planned traditional training to HRV guided training. And they were looking at HRV on a daily basis. If it was below baseline, I think if it was one standard deviation outside of their baseline, they would do lower training loads or rest. If it was within their baseline, then they would do higher intensity training. And that ended up resulting in meaningfully superior improvements in, I think, maximal treadmill speed and maybe VO2 max. Not to say that the other group didn't improve, but the HRV group did show greater responses. And then there was a recent paper by Dr. Veel Vesterinen and his colleagues. And they instead of using the acute change, they looked at the 7-day rolling average to basically plan training blocks for endurance training. And again, the HRV guided group tended to show, at least in some markers of fitness or performance, a superior response despite having less overall high intensity training days. So that just goes to show you, you know, whether you're looking at the acute day-to-day change or the rolling average, both can be useful and meaningful. It just depends on how sensitive you want, you're willing to be with manipulating training loads on a somewhat daily basis. I'm personally looking at the weekly mean, particularly if the training weeks are similar. If you have a competition at the on the weekend and training is kind of the same every week, I'm looking at how did they respond to the week? What was their coefficient of variation and their mean change? There's a parameter called the smallest worthwhile change, which for HRV, there's a number of ways we can determine that. In Martin Boucher's paper in Frontiers in Physiology, he recommends that a 3% change is meaningful. Daniel Plues in his paper in triathletes used 50% of the coefficient of variation as the smallest worthwhile change, whereas others have used, you know, are you one standard deviation outside of your baseline, which baseline itself is a topic worth discussing. So I would say to establish baseline, you're going to want about a week's worth of data, but that doesn't mean that you can't train during it. You're just getting something to start with. You're getting a starting point to compare the future to. So you just have to be mindful of what training loads are during that week of baseline you're establishing, and then you're just trying to see how it responds over time. A 1-month period, 4 weeks, may be superior to 7 days, but obviously you can't start out with 4 weeks of data. So start out with a week and go from there. Determine what your smallest worthwhile change is going to be. I personally like 50% of the coefficient of variation. That's what I've been using, especially because I'm not working with very high level endurance athletes, but rather I'm working with team sport athletes and so forth. They will change greater than 3% on a daily basis relatively regularly. The 3% is pretty narrow for athletes that have a higher coefficient of variation. So I like 50% of the coefficient of variation. And realistically, I'm not doing a whole lot of data analysis in Excel unless I'm doing this for research purposes and I have to report values and differences and so forth. What I'm looking at is the trend. I'm looking at the trend. And if they're trending upwards or downwards, if they're showing greater fluctuation or less fluctuation, these are what I'm looking at to determine how they're responding to training. So in a nutshell, there's not one specific way to do it. Just start getting data collected. And if you have an app or if you're savvy in Excel or some other program, plot the data over time. And it really does appear to limit how much you actually have to break down numbers and do these calculations if you know what you're looking for.
Andrew, if anyone has any questions or areas that they want to go ahead and contact you specifically in terms of HRV, what is the best way that they can do so?
I mean, for the quickest response, either Twitter or email. So I'm on Twitter at @Andrew_Flat. Or if you have a question that is not extensively comprehensive, you could just shoot me an email, hrvtraining@gmail.com. And I'll get to you as soon as I can. And I'm happy to help out and meet new people and so forth. So don't be shy to do so. I also have a blog called hrvtraining.com, which, it's kind of how a lot of this stuff started, where there wasn't a lot of public discussion outside of research on HRV and how to use it and what it was showing. So I started this blog that has evolved over time from just kind of being anecdotal, showing my own data or data of athletes I was working with and trying to come up with some kind of meaning of what's happening. And it's progressed to more sharing research and more in-depth articles on what's useful, whether it's methodological considerations with HRV monitoring, whether it's smartphone application nuances, and then just sharing any of our recent research. So you could keep up to date with what we're doing just by looking at the blog. And lastly, I just wanted to let everyone know that there's a really good colleague of mine, Dr. Brian Odey, is putting on a conference. It'll be hosted at California University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Mike Young will be speaking, Carl Valley will be speaking, Todd Hamer from Robert Morris University, and a few other colleagues of mine will be speaking on all things speed and training related. And this is May 13th and 14th. So if you're in the Pittsburgh area or surrounding area, this would definitely be a conference worth checking out to go see some of the best in the business speak. And you could get information on that, that I've been tweeting out some information. So is Mike Young, or you could also just go to naceinc.com to get the details. So I appreciate you having me today. I hope this was somewhat useful to the listeners, and I look forward to more podcasts and great content from the Historic Performance Podcast.
Andrew, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this information, and I'm going to make sure to link everything that you mentioned in terms of ways to contact you when I publish the podcast on my website. So thanks a lot, Andrew, and have a great day.
All right. Appreciate it, James.
Thanks again for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to head over to iTunes to leave a review and rating. It really helps others discover the show, and I'll greatly appreciate it. As I mentioned via Twitter, next week, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Tim Gabbett. So if you have any questions for him, use the hashtag HPP49 on Twitter, and I'll make sure to include the question within the episode. See you guys next week.